You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cutts.
Andy Kolbe is our guest. I have been really excited to have Andy on the show since her first book, Try Softer. Andy is the queen, the master of titling books that really provoke and make you think. But she's just released a second book, Strong Like Water. So obviously she's an author, she's a therapist. In both of those books and in her practice, she takes us into the deep world of attachment and trauma theory, but she does it in a way that really is soaked in gentleness. You get such a sense of her personality and her being as you read those books. She also gives us practical tools we can try. It's not just something you're learning about. It's something that she's actually leading you on. She shares much of her own story in those books, but also she tells on her clients, of course, with their permission. But it's so helpful just to get a front row seat to what healing and freedom can look like. Her main interest and specialty is connection to yourself, connection to others, connection to God. You can imagine why I was so keen to have her on the show, because as we say a lot around here, the only thing you have to offer the world is a well self. So for regular listeners, you know that I'm married to Lisa, the friendly neighborhood therapist. Lisa works in the same areas as Andy, and so she's joining on the chat today. I am surrounded by therapy nerds on this show, something I am thrilled to do. So I'll be doing a lot of listening and a learning today. Ladies, I'll be attuning today. I'll be attuned. So Andy, welcome to Managing Leadership Anxiety.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's really good to be with you.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to having you so much, Andy. I'll get my tears out of the way right at the beginning and just say you have a voice that models compassion and curiosity and comfort, right? So your work has been huge in my life. I think just the modeling of how we talk to one another and how we receive each other and receive then ourselves with all of our parts, you know, the hard and the good, beyond a book, just the modeling of that is something that I am so appreciative of from you. And so I just want to thank you for the work that you've done.
Wow, that is so meaningful to hear. And I sometimes think of like books, and what an honor it is to write them, but a little bit like children, you know, yeah. Like as you birth them, it's so amazing. Like at first you're just having to be so closely like watching them and, you know, helping to shape them. And then it feels like, especially, you know, with Try Softer, yes, has been out in the world like 3.5 years. And it feels similar. Like that book has sort of, found its own like way a little bit in the world, is like living its own little life. And now Strong Like Water, you know, is, you know, just 6 months old and needs a little, you know, needs a little more attention. But I think it's such a joy to get that kind of feedback, because it starts to feel separate than me. Yes. This little book that's out in the world doing these things. And so what a cool and surreal thing to get to hear about that.
Yes. So for our listeners who have not read Try Softer or heard of it, and then going into your book, Strong Like Water, could you just tell us for just a little bit the bridge, even just with the titles of those and the purpose behind those?
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I think at first, I think some people were like, okay, so softer, and now you're talking about stronger, you know, what are you totally switching? And I think for me, the way I've tried to explain it is that in many ways, you know, Try Softer, I think, birthed the capacity to talk about Strong Like Water. And in many ways, it's like they're definitely not polarities. They really are, in many ways, the same message with a different emphasis. Mm-hmm. I think of Try Softer as the internal posture that we have in our journey. It's a posture of compassionate attention, always, you know, regardless of what we're going through, that as we, you know, as we participate with God in developing the ability to pay compassionate attention, I think what it creates is the ability in strong like water to move along this flow of strength, to have the capacity to ride the waves of life, to feel the feelings, to listen to our bodies, to respond to our bodies. And so in many ways, I think of Trisofter like that's the internal posture. And then strong like water is almost like pulling out the camera. And you see it sort of the big, like it, for me, this is my attempt to say, here is, I think, a picture, a little bit of what it means for us to be human. You know, here are ways we survive. Here are ways we learn to come home to ourselves. Here are ways we ultimately, God willing, move through hard things. And so, yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, my hope is that we can soften into the paradoxes that exist. Mm-hmm. That it's not either you're strong and you disconnect from yourself, or you're weak and therefore soft. It's that, I think it's the Chinese philosopher, he said, Lao Tzu said, soft is strong. Yes. Because what is soft, you know, can be flexible and can move with. And so that was really part of my inspiration and desire to write the second book. Mm-hmm.
When you write about strength, you talk about it in these different ways, like these different categories. And one of the things you describe that you are concerned about is situational strength. I wonder if you just define what that is.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. So what I talk about in the book is that there's this flow of strength. And so this is the description of the types of strength we potentially access. And situational strength is, I think, a way of talking about our survival strength. It's the kind of strength where our body is experiencing the situation in some way. And it could be perception or it could be fully reality, but it feels life or death. And so because it feels life or death, you know, we are moving into our survival brain. So the lower parts of our brain where the only priority here is to survive. And so we do a lot to adapt. You know, I think of it as the grace of God that our bodies have the capacity to survive sometimes, you know, unthinkable things. And so situational strength, I really think of it as the ways that we adapt when we are in a life or death or perceived to be in a life or death situation.
Yeah. And if I read the book right, you kind of are suggesting that it's either overrated or this kind of idea that we just bear down and get through it. One of the triggers you wrote about that woke me up was the belief that others have it worse. Therefore, whatever I'm going through, I'm discounting. That would be an example of situational strength. I'm just going to get through it by bearing down. I was raised in the 1970s and 80s. Others had it worse is kind of the mantra of every parent. They weren't bad people. They just, that was the way they raised us. And so therefore, we don't tend to take seriously what's happening to us. What would be your response to that?
Yeah. So in the book, you know, I give all these ideas about ways situational strength could display itself. Because oftentimes, you know, I think from a trauma lens, we talk about things like fight or flight, potentially fawning, so over accommodating or to neutralize a threat, potentially dissociation. So technically, in my definition, all of those would be situational strength. But I think we can, our bodies are very, like the ways we adapt are even more creative than that, right? So the thing that you name, I think, is an example of the strategies we sometimes create, the patterns that sometimes begin to live in our body, oftentimes rooted in an experience or maybe multiple experiences that have been too much, too big, where there wasn't really enough support. You know, like for example, if a parent is the one saying that, what is that child facing that they are hearing don't complain because other has it worse, right? So if you've got a kiddo who's in the midst of something that they're experiencing is overwhelming to their nervous system, and instead of the parent coming alongside of the kiddo and being able to sort of attune and say, you know, well, what kind of help would you need? Or, you know, this is a lot, or this is big, or, you know what, maybe we do need to leave. Maybe whatever that parent could or potentially should do to help protect that kiddo, when instead it's like the message is, well, others have it worse, so essentially deal with it, right? You could see how easily that pattern could begin to get imprinted on your body, that it becomes the voice of, well, of course you need to keep pushing. Of course you can't listen to your limits. Others have it worse. And so therefore, a message like that might keep us in a pattern of when we have surpassed our limits, continuing to go hard, even when our body is trying to communicate that's too much.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. It feels like, as you use the example in parenting, it comes down, whether it's parenting or even the way we treat ourselves, to a fear, right? That we're not going to be able to be strong enough to handle even bigger things that come our way. Or in parenting, we've got to make sure our kids are strong enough as well. But in there is also the importance of attachment, as you talk about, for an appropriate type of strength. Can you lead us or say more in that as well?
Yeah. I, when I write my books, it's at times been challenging as a writer because I feel like I write in many ways how I do therapy. And in therapy, it feels like everything's on the table all at once. Like I want to have all the tools ready, right? Mm-hmm. But that can't always be true when you're writing a book. Like there has to be a little bit of like a, some sort of linear fashion in which you present information. But when I think about this work, it's always inextricable from relationship and therefore attachment. Because to some extent, all trauma is connected to relationship, right? Because there's a sense in which trauma can potentially disconnect us from ourselves. It can potentially disconnect us from others. It can potentially disconnect us from God. It can be all three at the same time. And partly the trauma also occurs sometimes because of the disconnection. It's like this way in which all these things, there's a reciprocation always. And so I see attachment as this role in which, certainly, like I want to be mindful that, you know, if someone has a car accident and they develop PTSD, that's gonna look a little different than if someone comes in and they're like, okay, I want to talk about the relationship that I have with my parents. But if a person who comes in and has PTSD from a car accident also has, a highly avoidant attachment style due to their upbringing, that's also going to impact how we do the work. And it has impacted how their nervous system has been shaped. And even their, what is called the window of tolerance, right? So that's this phrase from Dr. Dan Siegel of this range of arousal that our bodies can tolerate. And so different attachment styles, different ways we've experienced care will literally, they live, that template, those templates live in our body. Mm-hmm. And they affect how we feel our feelings or how we approach pain, how we allow people to care for us, how we repair or don't repair. All of these things are so integral, right? Because as we are in this journey of becoming strong like water, there's a way in which the care we've experienced is also the care that we carry in our body. So if we have a story about who we are, that we are not worthy of being cared for, it is going to impact our ability to, for example, feel our feelings completely. because that is going to potentially make it difficult for us to have the resources and the care to completely finish the cycle that needs to be finished. And so all that to say, in a way, it's like this attachment piece is so vital because it's both how we are experiencing other people, but then it is also how we are experiencing ourselves, how we're caring for ourselves. And I think in order to really do the work, for example, of strong like water and move along that flow of strength, examining that and bringing care and compassion to that internal posture really matters.
One of the things that I just think you have done a beautiful job of is talking about attachment to ourselves, attachment to others, and attachment to God. And as we know, just the freedom that that can happen in absolutely any order. And as we get permission for that, that that can also, for those who have experienced pain in a relationship, but also from the God card, that giving yourself permission to attach in any of those three areas can absolutely be healing balm for the other area that's so hard for you as well. So I guess my question is just more on that for our listeners and just humans that we all share that are trying to make sense. And so many of our listeners are church leaders or leaders in the home who are so promoting an truth about God and maybe don't always experience it, you know? And so experience this disconnect between the two. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. Yeah. And I love this. And I think I'm a big pattern person. I love looking for patterns. That's something I think that is why I love the way different theories work together. It's like I love finding the patterns. And when I think about this, I have lots of thoughts, but one of them would just be to say, if you're a person hearing that and you resonate with this feeling like, oh, I have all this head knowledge, I'm not experiencing it in my lived, my body, it's not visceral for me. I think that's really common. And I think it's really common, particularly right now in our culture. I mean, we can't escape the fact that I think Western culture tends to be really disembodied. And, I think there's so many things to talk about. In Trisofter, I talk about, like Gnosticism and the history of that as a heresy, and how I talk about this phrase I coined, functional Gnosticism, that oftentimes we give language to say, oh no, like we value the body, but in practice, we don't. like functionally, what actually happens is we value cognition. We value a type of knowledge that is a very specific kind of knowledge over the experiential knowing of something. And I think in truth, if part of our journey is to move towards wholeness, it's like we need the experiential knowing. That's that cognitive knowledge. It's not that it's bad. I think it can be a beautiful resource, but it's just one resource, right? And in order to experience integration, I think we need that deeper experience of embodied knowing. And so what it makes me think about is, for many folks, maybe they don't even really identify as a trauma survivor. Maybe that's not language that is resonant for them. And yet they have that feeling like, I know something, I can't feel it. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where it is helpful, and probably for you all, since I know you talk a lot about systems work, that there are so many systems at play, right? Like there's the cultural system, and then there's like our church systems, and then there's like our family systems. And as those are impacted by a way of experiencing the world that's primarily cognitive, over also valuing the embodied experience, which oftentimes has roots in like generationally, that's what's been valued. Right? So there may never have been one decision, like the body is bad. Mm. It's that as something gets passed on in our live in the experiential, like being with each other, that the living out of it is valued less than. Mm-hmm. I think we oftentimes pick that belief up, right? We pick it up without even the conscious words of saying like, this doesn't matter as much. So much of my work and a lot of what I'm passionate about is I think of it, I hope, as a necessary corrective to say, it's not that cognition doesn't matter. It's that we have often, and in the Western church often, overvalued cognitive knowing, and we have undervalued the body. And so, I think even from a faith perspective, to live at the incarnational reality of our God. I mean, for me, that's something that keeps me deeply tethered to Jesus, is the incarnational reality of God. And even that, from a attachment lens, what does it mean that a God would come near to be embodied? That the significance of that, even in like relationship, when someone's trying to repair, to come closer, to say, I want to understand. I want to be with you. I want to walk with you through it. I'm not going to leave you, right? So I think a lot of us have been sort of formed in this other way. And it has made it difficult to experience maybe a reality that's always been present. But maybe because of the ways that our bodies have been shaped to undervalue experience, we don't always have sort of the eyes to see, the awareness and the willingness to partake of that, in that deeper knowing. And so there's lots of overlap here where sometimes this is why we have to, why it matters to go in to our story with compassion and to learn, well, where did I learn? Where did I pick up that message? Where did I learn? You know, I would say this is a version of situational strength. Where did I learn my body didn't matter? Where did I learn my limits don't matter? Where did I learn that I can't trust the messages that come from my body? And how can I bring compassion and curiosity as I unlearn that?
Yeah, it just feels like you're breaking the rules of guest etiquette here, Andy, where you're kind of rummaging around. In, you know, 35 years of my faith journey, I've been a Christian about 35 years. And what you said is exactly right, is that it's not that the brain is wrong. It's just so over, we put way too much stock in it. And as I was listening to you, I was just thinking, it's not that we don't believe we should embody faith, like feel freedom in our body. I think a lot of us just didn't even know that was possible on the table. Like, we, to your point, we have been so conditioned to think through our faith that it was several years ago for me, I was really convicted that anytime someone asks how I'm doing, I just say I'm fine, which is really code for I have no idea how I'm doing, or I don't want to think about how I'm doing. I would rather focus on others and pretend that that's fulfilling the law of Christ. One of the tools that you write about that is so helpful is grounding, is just helping us become grounded. I'd love to hear from you about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that and for sharing that. And I think that's a really common experience for people, you know? And so I appreciate you saying what you did. And so grounding is a tool that I talk about it everywhere I go. but it's partly because it's just so accessible. And what I think about is, so, you know, I mentioned, like, for example, the window of tolerance. So I'll just, if I could just step back for a second and say, situational strength and the window of tolerance, there's an important connection and understanding that when we go out of that window of tolerance, basically we go into either our sympathetic nervous system, so that's like fight, flight, fawn. So there's a sense of mobilization when we go into sympathetic. And then into the, if that doesn't neutralize the threat, we will then move down into sort of a dissociative, this is from our dorsal vagal response. It's sort of like a feeling of disconnection, can feel numb, we might feel depressed. So for listeners who don't know about this, these are all really important parts of how we survive. We need them. If our body perceives that a threat is too big, this is how we are designed to respond. And this is a really good thing, because in the absence of these responses, psychologically, if we didn't have that kind of protection, I think the actual pain we would feel, or the chances of us experiencing more harm, are really high. So it's, I just say that because I think a lot of people carry shame if they do go into some sort of response. And I just love to just share that this is there for a reason, and it's a beautiful reason, because it's to keep us safe.
And to be honored, but, right? Like that's, I mean, I feel like I'm over here, if we yes. could be on video, would just be dancing with this. But I mean, wow, we have a creator who made our nervous systems that way so that we can survive is such, I mean, it's an honor, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think there's just, again, I think of it like a necessary corrective, right? So many people, I myself am a survivor of complex trauma, and I just, it has been deeply important to have compassion for how my body was shaped, how my nervous system was shaped, and why my body has responded at times the way that it has. I think it's an important permission for people to hear about those mm-hmm. responses. Now, it doesn't mean we always want to go into a trauma response. Like if we're in a situation that's not threatening and our body's reacting as though it is, we want to bring compassion. And part of the work is learning to bring enough safety so that we don't have to go there. So all that to say, to your question about grounding, I think one of the reasons why I share this is to say, when we go into either situational strength or we're going out of that window of tolerance, meaning essentially our body's like, the threat is too big, it feels too big. When grounding is a great resource in the sense that it's a very accessible way to help connect to some safety, particularly if the thing that is feeling activating is really about something from the past, right? Because if we are in an actually traumatic and or unsafe situation, it may be that we actually want our body to do what it needs to do, because in some ways there's a wisdom, like maybe you need to run. Like maybe that's exactly what needs to happen, you know? So I bring in a lot of caveats. But grounding is a way of using our five senses to bring us into the immediate present as much as possible. And we do this in part because God willing, the present is actually safe. And for folks who might be getting activated around trauma, one thing to know is that a lot of the imprint of trauma is deeply connected to the right hemisphere of like our amygdala. And so when that begins to get activated, our right hemisphere cannot tell the difference between past and present. So essentially that means if we are fully into a trauma response, we don't know when we are. Like, so if the trauma that's getting activated happened when you're 10 years old, then you feel 10. Like, that's what's happening, right? So as much as possible, using these five senses is a way, as we're able, to reorient us to the present moment. Mm-hmm. Because again, if we've lost that sense of time, part of what we're doing is we're essentially helping to repair some of that by bringing us back to what actually is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's lots of different ways to do grounding. And ideally, we do this before we're all the way out of the window, right? Because sometimes it's like we're a little bit, if we get too far out, we may not have the presence of mind to be like, I need to do grounding. But, you know, I say to folks, like we're starting to go into a new season, and so this is not as accessible, but like if you can get outside and put your feet in the grass and to notice those sensations, notice what are you smelling and what are you hearing and what can you touch and is there anything you can taste? And as we're doing this, it's not a formula so much as it is, I think of it almost like a layering, right? So the more activated you are, the more resources we need. So you may need longer, you know, you may need longer noticing what's in your immediate surrounding, or counting how many blades of grass are in this square, or really feeling the gravity push you down to the ground. Mm-hmm. And I know for a lot of people, when they first hear about grounding, they can sound a little bit like, I don't know, silly, like a little funny. But I think that the value of a practice like this is that we're really working to start with the body. Mm-hmm. We're not trying to think our way into safety. Mm-hmm. We can't do that. We must live into it, mm-hmm. in order for our body to pick up those cues.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a way of getting out of more of the same, right? If we're used to thinking, I've got to think my way out. I've got to think everything. It's more letting the body feel so that we can connect and make sense of what's going on, so that we can, yeah, be aware of our body and our brain, and they can work beautifully together.
One thing I'm thinking about as I'm listening, like both of you guys are therapists, you deal with a lot of trauma, a lot of people who have profound pain. So that would also be many of our listeners, Andy. Like, they are very aware of what they're carrying, what's carrying them. And this would be really resonating with them. We also have listeners who may be more like the way I used to be, which is, nothing really that bad happened to me. This all sounds like when I hear threat, safety, partly because I'm a large white man, I don't believe I'm under threat or in danger very often. And also, I blame Jesus, if you put it this way, to focus on others. Like, I'm just going to focus on the mission. I'm just going to serve other people. And I claim that that's fulfilling the law of Christ, which, when it's really ignoring what's going on in me. But I would love just to hear from you on, okay, if you're speaking to somebody who maybe is not as aware of what they're carrying or what's carrying them, how do they begin to notice the threat when it doesn't feel like a threat? That's the challenge when you're a big white guy like me. Threats don't feel like threats. They often come out as anger or irritability, but they don't feel like a threat. And so how might you coach someone like myself to notice what's really a threat?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's a great question. And I think that is so true. And part of the challenge, and I think sometimes in talking about these things, is that you're trying to honor the fullness,
yeah,
like the right. full spectrum of what it means to be human, all the way from so significant that there's just such a deeply felt impact, to the point where it's like, it's not that there's not an impact, but perhaps the ability to disconnect from the impact is really good or so effective that there's oftentimes little awareness of the impact, right? And so I think one of the things I would say is that getting curious about, you know, you name like anger. And I think anger is a great place, something to get curious with, right? Because I think oftentimes, and particularly for men, because often anger is less accessible for women. I think that has a lot to do with socialization and more accessible for men, right? And so often when anger is the only emotion that feels accessible, it's like there's trying to be like a release somewhere. And it's like, that's it. That's your only place where you can have a feeling. And so I like to encourage folks to get curious about their reactions. Like, you know, this idea that when a reaction for something like anger feels disproportionate to the situation, this gives us a lot of information about, you know, I'm using language like threat and safety, but I think for most people, that is not always going to feel that's not going to always feel resonant because of exactly the reasons, you know, we live in a first world country with lots of privileges. There's, you know, and there's lots of reasons why you would think, oh, that's not true. But I think if a couple of things, one, if we can notice those inconsistencies, those mismatches, they sometimes tell us more information about what is going on with our body. And so, you know, for someone whose main emotion that they experience is anger, to be able to get curious about like, oh, when my wife asked me a question about X and I just got so angry, would be a great place to bring some curiosity about that. Like for example, you know, and this probably starts to go into some IFS language, but wondering about if there might be, you know, one, is there something that anger feels like it has to protect? Mm-hmm. Or is what is that anger afraid of would happen? If something else, you know, if there was something underneath that needed to be expressed. Because oftentimes that initial reaction, something like anger, looks really strong, right? Mm-hmm. If we go back to the idea of situational strength, anger can absolutely be situational strength, mm-hmm. right? Because it's serving a purpose and it outwardly looks very strong, mm-hmm. classically strong, right? But if we think about how I feel in my body, like for example, like is your heart racing? Mm-hmm. What's going on in your chest? What are you noticing in your body? As we begin to get curious, actually we may notice that that situation feels life or death too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? So if we can come from that place, we have something then to work with. Like what about this situation is feeling threatening that we would need that level of a response. Mm-hmm. And that gives us a space to, and different people are gonna have a different journey because maybe it was how you were talked to when you had a problem. Maybe it was that anytime you had an emotion, you were shamed. Maybe it was that when you really needed some care because you were very sad and had your worst days, you were left totally on your own. And there was no support and there was nobody there. And so it felt really unsafe for anyone to approach those emotions. Mm-hmm. So I think for folks who are listening, I would encourage you to get curious with the layers because oftentimes, I mean, our bodies are excellent at keeping us safe, you know, protected. Mm-hmm. And often we don't always know that the true threat has passed. And so the deeper work is giving our body the information, the cues of safety needed so that the ways we're staying safe, like the ways we're like situationally strong can sort of almost like slough off. Mm-hmm. And what's the more tender wound there that's asking to be cared for?
Yeah.
So that we can have deeper connection with ourselves, others, and God.
Mm. Yeah. So good. So good. Where do you want to go?
Yeah, let's tackle this one.
Go ahead.
Oh. Our last thing, Andy, before we take a little musical brain break, it's related to what you were just saying, the difference between discomfort and harm. You know, one of your foundational assumptions is the need for safety and that safety, when you feel safe and secure, that's when you can thrive as a human. There is a faith tradition that speaks about risk and pouring it all out, but you're not talking about different things. Talk to us about discomfort and harm.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things, you know, I talk about in Strong Like Water is that, you know, I mean, for people, for followers of Jesus, I think we often rest in paradox. I mean, our whole faith is a paradox. Like we live in an upside down kingdom. We have a God who says the first will be last, who invites little children, who says when you're weak, then you are strong. I mean, this is such a deeply, this paradox idea and paradigm, I think is often where followers of Jesus are called to rest. And I think that, you know, when I use the words safety, part of what I'm talking about is this idea that we need enough. Another way to say it would be enough attunement and connection. Like if we were not going to use safety, like we need enough attunement and connection, either inside of us, in between us, or outside of us. Those are the ways therapist Deb Dana talks about the experience of felt safety. That's what makes up felt safety. But what's important to understand is that each of those are also a pathway to building more safety. Like if you have access to any of those, you essentially have access to building more safety. And so when I think about that, and going back to your question, I sometimes say we need enough safety to help us be uncomfortable. This is the paradox. Like, you can't truly be uncomfortable if you have no access to safety. And so for folks, for example, who have a history of unresolved trauma, there is a lot of disturbance that may live in that person's body. And so it's like there has to be even more care. Mm-hmm. Paid attention to how that is worked through and worked with, because it's not coming from a blank slate. It's coming from, if something in that person's lived experience gets activated, it literally feels unsafe in their body. And so to go back to that paradigm, it's like, so we need enough safety, all the places that we've named, we need enough safety to be able to be with. Mm-hmm. The things that have been felt deeply scary, harmful, disturbing. And so I would say, from a faith lens, for me, one of my deep beliefs is that our faith can be one of the most important, if not the most important resource we could have. Mm-hmm. But this begs for the need for our faith to actually be a resource.
Yes.
Meaning, if we've experienced harm through our faith, if it's only cognitive, we may want it to be a resource. Mm-hmm. But if our body's not experiencing that way, and then we're like, oh, and then go pour yourself out.
Right.
Right. We don't have access to something.
Yeah.
That allows us, right? It's not the tether. Right? It's not enough safety to be uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so for your listeners, that's what I would say, is where are you getting nourished? Where do you get poured into to have enough so that you can pour out?
Yeah.
Right? And this is where all these like inside us, outside us, in between us, these are all these almost like routes and by which we can experience goodness and safety and connection and nourishment. But if none of those are present, it's a recipe for harm or burnout.
Yes.
And or both.
Yes.
When you wrote Strong Like Water, you know, I'm sure you anticipated you'd have interviews. I know recently you got to be on Good Morning America. We watched that interview. It was amazing to see. I think it was like a 4-minute interview and just your ability to really help people see what that was. So I'm sure you anticipated just the need to get on podcasts, but you surely did not anticipate the gauntlet of anxiety questions. And so we just have 5 for you today. You can pass or play on any of them. These are all optional, but I think you'll probably sail through. Here's question number one. What have you found helpful to deal with loneliness?
Loneliness has certainly been a part of my story. I think for me, one thing that has been really important is focusing on a few folks that I really connect with deeply versus needing to connect everywhere all the time. That depth of connection, and then even the connection with myself, has been so important. And the one other thing I'll add is that I have developed some great writer friendships, and we keep in contact through things like Voxer. And that is just a great, great way to just sort of continue that connection.
So good. In your work, right, we know you've talked about the importance of taking care of yourself and being so keenly aware, right, of our parts and how we respond to things. So if you were honest, it's either what types of people or what perceived actions, either way, trigger you the most. You have to do some work around.
Yeah. You know, part of my story is... you know, partly because of my history, I am complex.
Yeah.
I have developed some quite complex parts, which I have come to really value, just all that they have done. But I would say one of the things for me is that I have, when someone, I think that a sense of like entitlement towards me activates a fawn part, right? But then also like another part of me that's like, oh, I don't want to give more than I have to give. And so it creates this fawn part I utilize to survive a very, very tumultuous home, having to really walk on eggshells, often give more than I was okay with, or, you know, things like that. And so I have come a long way, but that is something that I really have to continue to like honor and like notice and give myself breaks and things like that.
And permission and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So you know, we all carry our family of origin into our environments, whether we want to or not. And of course, sometimes they drag us into environments as well. Particularly wanting to be aware of complexity in being raised. What might be one asset and one liability that you've inherited from your family of origin?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think an asset for sure. My mom was a refugee out of Budapest, Hungary in 1956. She escaped in the back of an ambulance during the communist revolution. And so, yeah, she, you know, part of her story, I mean, she has lots, just a very, very complex story and lots of trauma. But one of the things that we talk about with my mom is that she has, we call it her Hungarian fire. And I feel that, I mean, I feel like I have that Hungarian fire, you know, and I talk about that a little bit in Strong Like Water, like this part of myself, a lot of it I got to express when I was younger, really through playing basketball. And that was like a sort of a venue. And part of my own journey has really been working with that part to reintegrate the fire, to not be afraid of the fire. But I mean, there's a great quote by, I think, a person named Kazuhaga, and they say, you know, if trauma is passed down through our genes, and it certainly is, then so is our resilience. And I would say some of the things that my mom lived through are like, it's almost like she shouldn't be here. You know, she shouldn't be here. And yet there's like this sense of like, wow, like I carry that in me. And I'm really, like, I'm proud of that. I'm proud that I carry that tenacity and that fire. So that would be one thing I'm really grateful for. And I think on the other hand, I think, we've got some legacies of trauma, generations of trauma. And that has been a deeply, what is even the word that honors the bigness of what it has meant in my life to sort of tell the truth. Yes. I think that's probably what I would say, that there is a deep belief in me that I will not pretend, because I was past a lot of generational trauma, and I'm certainly not perfect, but I think it's been really important for me to honor reality, is what I would say. And I think that oftentimes in service of not wanting to rock the boat, we can't always feel like we honor the fullness of reality. And I think in my story, there is a lot of grief around, I think, the extent to which how much things broke down. I talk about it like things sort of broke all the way. They burned, sort of feels like they burned all the way down. And that's so painful. And so it has meant for me that the way forward has been honoring the truth of that and not pretending and not trying to put rose-colored glasses on the truth of that aspect of it.
Yeah. So good. Thank you for that. Where do you experience a gap between what you believe and what you experience?
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes, I think it ebbs and flows for sure. But yeah, sometimes like doing things, like It's not that hard for me to make sure that my kids get like their lunches made and some of those things. And at different times, particularly when I have a fuller plate, like making sure I'm doing things like making myself my own lunch. And like taking the time to take care of myself in ways that feel, that's pretty basic. But my husband would be like, why did you only eat tortilla chips for lunch? And I'm like, you know, you're right. It's like, I feel like I'm like, oh, but I want to do this. So I let this thing that is really important, like I really, it's important that I eat, you know, and I let this thing slide. And so, and for me, I find that as I come back to center, it's easier. Like, it's like, I have to be like, oh, no, nothing over here is more important than doing these really basic things. You know, obviously, like caveats, life or death, things like that. But generally speaking, as a way of being, like, I deserve to eat lunch. And so I think that at times, like, that's where I continue to have a lot of compassion and be like, yep, nope, I know it's hard. I know you don't want to stop and just make yourself lunch right now. And so I think that's one place where I notice it.
Okay, you sailed through the gauntlet, much to my great displeasure, by the way. Just your final question, Andy, we've got one more for you. When in your life in the last few weeks have you felt most fully and completely loved?
Yeah, it's a beautiful question. I think that probably, I think one of my favorite things, so our kids started school, it's probably been like 3.5 weeks, but sometimes I think when we're all really tired, we'll just be like, you know, we'll have dinner and they're like, okay, let's snuggle on the couch and like watch a good movie for a little bit. And I love doing that. And so there has definitely just been a couple times when it's like, you know, our kids are just fried. They're back to school. They have all these new transitions and just being like with them and with Brendan and just in that little space, you know, just like a little bit of a container of like our little family, having that time of just like, it's okay. Yeah. Well, let's just be together. I think that would probably be true.
I love it.
Our guest is Andy Kolber. Just as I was listening to her talking particularly about the family of origin gauntlet question, I think what struck me, I'm not sure, Lisa, what your reaction was, but I could feel both of us having quite a reaction, but just the absolute power of the gospel and bravery. It's more than just believing the gospel. It's also doing very brave work that now Andy's vocation and your household have a different story than the one you inherited. And that's what I think makes you such a powerful healer. Andy's books are Try Softer and Strong Like Water. Strong Like Water is the current release. We'll have links to both in the show notes. Cannot go wrong with either. Much better off with both. And as is the case with most of this kind of work, the work that Andy's doing, really done best in community. So grab this book for your small group, your community group, your friend group, and go through it slowly. It's rich. Andy, thank you so much for giving us your time coming on Managing Leadership Anxiety.
Absolutely.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.